Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, the weekly news and commentary podcast about the emanations and penumbras of liberty. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangue. Ward, happy VE Day. Grunts.
Howdy.
Happy Monday.
We are going to talk about the A word here in a moment. But first, even fancy pants health insurance policies don't generally cover the cost of air transport should you need a skylift to a medical facility. That's where Air Med Care Network steps in with gusto. When you join the Air Med Care Network, if such an emergency arises, you will not see a bill for air transport when flown by a participating AMCN provider. This peace of mind for your entire household can be yours, beginning at the low, low price of $85 a year. This service is not theoretical. AMCN helps transport more than 100,000 patients a year. Listeners to the Roundtable who sign up right now will also receive a gift card from Visa or Amazon worth up to $50. Just visit airmedcarenetwork.com/reason and use the offer code REASON and start protecting your family ASAP. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. Okay, 1 week ago, not long after we posted our previous episode of the Reason Roundtable podcast, Politico leaked out the first draft opinion written in February by Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito in the abortion case Dobbs versus Jackson's Women's Health Organizations. Too many apostrophe S's. Alito's opinion, as written, would overturn Roe versus Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey, the two key precedents on which rests the constitutional right for women to have an abortion in the pre-viability period of their pregnancy. Subsequent reporting by the Washington Post has indicated that as of late April, there still exists a majority on the court ready to strike down Roe. The Mississippi law at issue in Dobbs would ban almost all abortions after 15 weeks of pregnancy, which would be a significant ratchet downward in a prohibited gestation period from the more typical 22 to 24 weeks or so where such bans are in place. Republican lawmakers on the state and local level have for years, half a century almost, been preparing for this moment, creating a bunch of trigger laws that would prohibit many currently legal abortions the moment that any Roe reversal goes into effect. The news, predictably, has been a huge political bombshell. Supreme Court has big fenced barriers around its perimeter. There's angry protesters gathering outside the private residences of the Supreme Court justices, particularly on the conservative side. And there are daily, hourly, minutely, that's a word, predictions of various legal and political dystopias going forward. Catherine, help us frame this discussion, if you will. What's your general sense about how significant the Dobbs decision, if it's somewhere along the lines of what we've seen, could be on this little thing we call liberty?
My general sense is that for people who are skeptics of state power, this decision is very bad news. I think that is a different thing than what a lot of people in this country seem to believe will happen when Roe comes down, which is that there seems to be a belief that abortions everywhere will immediately become illegal, and that will be the end of the conversation. That is not what's going to happen. Jacob Sullum and many others at Reason have written quite clearly and eloquently about the ways in which this becomes an issue for the states. And we will therefore see lots of different legal requirements and restrictions around abortion all over the country. But, you know, I am pro-choice in the same way that I am an anarchist, which is to say that I am very radical in the most boring possible way. And so for me, what this decision is about is basically taking a dent out of the idea of self-ownership, right? I have the right to my body. I have dominion over my body. I have the right to say what or whom goes into it. And this logic gets you self-defense. It gets you drug legalization. It gets you sexual choice. Maybe if you like stretch it a little bit, it gets you like freedom of conscience and free speech, but it definitely gets you legal abortion. And I think lots and lots and lots of libertarians, especially, but not just libertarians, share that instinct. And to say that we are going to give the state or the states More control over more of our bodies is something that people who care a lot about liberty shouldn't be excited about, in my view. I don't love rights language, and we can talk about that a little bit more later. I just think on some level, people who talk about rights are never going to convince people who don't already buy their exact same overlapping set of rights. But I think that there is a kind of secondary argument here, which is, you know, what will the impact be on all kinds of other liberties, including privacy, including private property? And Elizabeth Nolan Brown has written very eloquently about the many, many, many ways that bringing down Roe could influence and impact not just women of childbearing age, but almost everyone's privacy and personal autonomy.
Nick, as someone who I think it's fair to say broadly agrees with Catherine's approach towards that question, there's a case being made by a lot of conservatives and even some libertarians that the court would be, in effect, doing us a favor by kicking this back down to the states and even local level, because that's going to encourage legislators to actually make laws instead of waiting for the diktat of an unelected nine people. And then, that forges necessary compromise on the political level, and it restores some kind of civic nature and federalism. What say you?
Yeah, I think that's broadly speaking horseshit, and it's results-based. The only people making that argument seriously are people who are anti-abortion or want to see abortion heavily restricted. You can totally agree that Roe is bad law and things like that, but for 50 years, by guaranteeing a right of abortion through the first two trimesters and then later in Planned Parenthood v. Casey, through viability, we reached a remarkable consensus in balancing the rights of women and the rights of fetuses. In 1975, about 19% of people opposed abortion under all circumstances. It is exactly the same. Roe, rather than being talked about as, this overreach and it's bad, blah, 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 somehow it managed to capture exactly where people are. And I think anybody who is serious about this will recognize that each side, broadly speaking, pro and anti-abortion, they have arguments in their favor, and there is something to balance between fetal rights, which develop, and get bigger and, get more powerful towards the end of a pregnancy, and women's rights to bodily autonomy, which are strongest at the beginning of a pregnancy. This also models exactly when abortions take place. 97% or something like that, or 98% take place before 13 weeks. 1% take place after 20-something. I mean, so this should be recognized not as some kind of reckoning, finally, we're getting back to constitutional rights. This is about a small minority of people who want to ban abortion getting closer to doing that. Catherine's right that it'll go back to the states, and states will vary. But I think that, the right to abortion, certainly in the early part of a pregnancy, is a fundamental right. It's a basic right. And it's not something that somebody who lives in Texas or Mississippi should have to travel hundreds, possibly thousands of miles to get. And on a larger point, you can already see that, people who are kind of encouraged by this are already talking about, we're going to have to start talking about banning women from traveling out of states where abortion is illegal. Marco Rubio has, started talking about legislation that would target tax treatment of benefits that companies like Apple that said they'll pay for women's travel expenses to go to things. It's not simply about abortion. It's about a lot of other stuff. And it's bad for liberty, I would say.
Peter, Nick nodded to the politics of it. Kind of, Roe has always been criticized as its predecessor Griswold, that kind of enabled or located the right to privacy. It's been criticized for being kind of a dog's breakfast in terms of legal reasoning. There's a fascinating backstory about that, of basically the liberal justice on the Supreme Court wanting to avoid having to find the 14th Amendment applying to economic rights. But let's table that for a second and plug for reasoned content here. Just read Jacob Solem, Damon Root, and the whole entire Volokh conspiracy. Including and also a podcast last week that Nick did with Josh Blackman, talking about the nuts and bolts legal stuff, which is beyond the purview of this roundtable. But Peter, the politics of this which, as Nick pointed out, of Roe, have been kind of congruent or pretty well aligned with where American politics have been in practical effect. That's certainly something that John Roberts, Chief Justice, has always been interested in, at least on certain high-level court cases, of kind of squaring American politics and the politics of the court with decisions, and then he finds ever more elaborate ways to do that. You have experience watching his own emanations and penumbras and trying to figure out how to adjudicate Obamacare cases. What, if anything, can we learn from the Chief Justice's role? And he's not in this. He's right now, he's in the minority, as far as we know. Per reporting, he's kind of jawboning and trying to peel off some of the conservative majority. But what lessons, if any, are applicable from the Obamacare cases and Chief Justice John Roberts' sort of political instincts about this?
So Roberts is concerned first and foremost about the Supreme Court's legitimacy, possibly even more than he's concerned about the particular outcome or decision of any single case, but especially when it comes to highly divisive cases like this. I think in part his concern has always been there. You know, he talked about the court being a neutral arbiter that calls balls and strikes when he was confirmed. But I also think that the experience of Citizens United, which proved to be deeply divisive, has cemented this in his style. And so he believes that for the court to function, people need to trust its rulings and abide by its decisions. And the way he wants to preserve the court's legitimacy is by attempting to maintain the public perception that the court is this neutral, apolitical body. And in order to maintain the public perception of neutrality, he has generally favored narrower rulings rather than more sweeping rulings. But that, in turn, sometimes means rulings that bend over backwards to accept and uphold fairly dubious legislative ideas. For example, as you mentioned, the Obamacare case. So when that case initially went to the Supreme Court, reporting has shown after the fact that the justices met and Roberts initially voted to overturn the individual mandate in Obamacare, which was a mandate to carry health insurance that meets federal specifications. And then, as this process was unfolding, as the justices were sort of working through writing their rulings and sort of what they were going to say, he switched his vote in the middle of the process, adopting a saving construction. He ended up writing the ruling there, and basically he came up with a constitutional rationale to keep the individual mandate legal. He called it a tax on inactivity rather than a command on economic activity, even though President Obama had said several times quite publicly, this is not a tax. Now, the legal team had said, look, if you don't want to accept this as a command, you can accept this as a tax. So they did make the legal argument. But this was explicitly contravening the Democratic argument that this was in no way a tax. Absolutely not. It was just a shared responsibility payment, I believe, was the lingo that they used. But you can see the problem here that develops from this approach to maintaining legitimacy. There's a kind of a contradiction inherent here, because what Roberts is trying to do is preserve the court's legitimacy by maintaining this public sense, hopefully, that it is an apolitical body. But he's doing so through what is transparently political management of the judicial process and acting as a kind of he is very much a political actor here, even like, but in service of pretending that the court isn't political.
Catherine, I'm but a simple potato farmer, as we know, so I'm not necessarily inclined to have deep, long conversations about, you know, rights, man. But since you teased it previously, what is wrong with treating your very eloquent sort of discussion of bodily autonomy as a right? Rights, isn't that what we're talking about with the Supreme Court? Right? This is about rights, isn't it? What's wrong with that?
Yeah, I mean, this is this is above the pay grade of the simple potato farmer, I guess, but let's try. I am a consequentialist. I think that in the end, when you look very, very hard for a way to ground your philosophy in stuff like rights, in sort of universal, inviolable principles, that you don't get a lot to stand on. That it's very, very hard to sort of build a philosophy not only that sort of works within itself, but also that you can convince other people to join you in. Because after all, it is no good to make a perfect philosophical system if your brethren do not buy into it to some degree. Now, I think that as a consequentialist, as someone who just thinks that we should try to maximize the utils, as the kids say, sort of look for a world in which people have the most happiness or well-being, that you end up with something that looks a lot like rights. You end up with these sort of rules of behavior, because if you try to do the math every single time on every single decision, you get into a troublesome place quite quickly. But I think when you take this consequentialist worldview, one thing that you realize is this question, which we are often very, very preoccupied with when it comes to abortion, which is it a life? Is it a rights-bearing creature, this fetus, this baby, whatever you want to call it? And of course, even your choice of language already gives away the game in many of these conversations. I think that a much more interesting question is to say, you know, how do we build a system that makes the most people the most well off, and to use the language of duty rather than rights, because that doesn't immediately map onto the law. So I think the interesting question is to say, if I am pregnant, what is my duty to the fetus? And that is a way of asking kind of what I owe this other creature, this life. I don't have to decide what the moral status of that thing is. I can just think about what I owe to any other kinds of people. And libertarians, I think, have a very good and healthy view, which is that, like, we don't owe absolutely everything to everyone, right? I mean, I think there are lots of people who would build our politics to say, if I have $1 more than you, the state should take it and give it to you. And libertarians instinctively rebel against that. I think you can take that logic all the way down to abortion and say, you know, I don't owe other beings, I don't owe other creatures anything. Now, I might have a duty to them. I might have it might be morally laudatory to help out people who need help, up to and including a helpless fetus hanging out in my womb. But that the language of rights takes us too quickly and dangerously, I think, into the realm of law, in a place where sometimes the law has no business.
Nick, changing tacks there, obviously. But thank you for that, Catherine. I almost understood. There's been a lot of discussion about the leak itself.
Potatoes have rights.
Potatoes have absolute rights.
Mr. Potato Head
can we,
has rights.
I mean, point out, though, that, you know, I'm not sure I want to jump away from rights that quickly,
but
the
Matt
fetus
does,
developed.
And he's the host.
Well, you know, I'm the guest, so I'm going to push back if Matt can Indian leg wrestle me or Native American leg wrestle me into submission. But there's a difference at 6 weeks and at 6 months. And that is something that was encoded historically in laws through the parts of the 19th century, where before and after quickening, you know, abortion was treated differently. But also, we know this, that a six-week-old fetus is different than a six-month-old fetus. We treat miscarriages at 6 weeks radically different than at 6 months or at 8 months. And that's worth, you know, it's worth recognizing, because things change and there are two entities here. And I just following up on Catherine's discussion, you know, the duty, it changes for the woman, I think. And that's part of what we have hammered out, a fantastically stable, good political consensus, that this is now threatening to overturn and turn into, you know, a massive culture war that didn't need to happen.
All right. I want to ask you that question then. Peter, protests outside of the Supreme Court Justice's house right now. I think Jim Psaki today said that, criticized this pretty forthrightly. The President Joseph Robinette Biden had previously been kind of lukewarm about the prospect of people getting pretty angry outside Brett Kavanaugh's joint. You brought up something on the Slack channel previously, and I know we're not supposed to talk about Slack channel, but it was actually a factual nugget that somehow this has something to do with the disinformation board chair, Nina Jankowicz. Can you connect that dot for us?
Yeah. So recently on this podcast, we talked about Nina Jankowicz, who is not Biden's disinformation czar, but I'm going to call her Biden's disinformation czar because that's a that's a convenient
Tsarina.
Shorthand, right?
Tsarina.
I'm sure. And so we talked about her book, How to Lose the Time War or the Information War or the what the one that Catherine tried to read and then ended up reading a science fiction novel instead.
It's
but
the
there's
time
another
warp.
Book that she wrote titled How to Be a Woman Online, and the subtitle is Surviving Abuse and Harassment and How to Fight Back. And I read the opening chapter to this book because I thought that it might prove sort of instructive in this. And it starts with this fascinating hypothetical scenario that describes a woman waking up in her apartment and coming out of her apartment and walking along the street to get to her office. And as this happens, she describes, in her words, a mob gathering in front of the entrance to your building. And they're jeering and they're shouting insults. She includes the line, their cries pelt you from all angles. Right? So there's like a lot of people outside your apartment building and they're yelling at you and they're being really rude. And she prints a bunch of nasty and obnoxious quotes. And then the twist is, this didn't happen in real life, but it did. All of these quotes are real things that people have said to her online. Right? And then there is this remarkable passage that she follows this with. Most thinking, feeling individuals would be appalled to encounter a scene like this on the street. They would, we hope, intervene in some way. They'd offer to walk you into your building, accompany you to your home, or even call the police. Law enforcement might make some arrests, or at the very least, disperse the crowd. We could expect such interventions in real life. So I guess I just wonder what Nina Jankowicz thinks about all of the protests outside of these Supreme Court justices' houses.
Well, what do you think, though? I mean, is it? I don't think it's necessarily should be illegal, but it's awful.
It's not illegal, and I don't even necessarily think it should be illegal. I agree with you. I mean, Robbie Suave in this morning's Reason Roundup wrote, I think correctly, the street and sidewalk are public spaces. It's permissible to protest there. The Bill of Rights enshrines people's right to protest. There's no right enjoyed by government actors to avoid witnessing protests, even those that might make them somewhat anxious or uncomfortable outside their house. I added some of that. Robbie did not write all of those words, but many of them. And I think that's right. At the same time, I don't condone this. I don't think it's appropriate. I don't think it, and I frankly also just don't think that it's tactically wise if you are a pro-choice supporter. That sort of aggressive activism is not something that I have ever been particularly interested in myself. And I think that the people who are involved in this should think twice just about the tactics, but also about the ways that the left has talked about harassment, and in particular online harassment, and you know, the feeling of discomfort, and right, the ways that people have been targeted, often for their political beliefs and for political speech. There's some Pew research data finding that very large numbers of Americans have been targeted for harassment online over the last couple of years, and in many cases, I believe the number one cause for that is because of political speech. And the left has spent the last several years saying that's bad. You shouldn't mob people even online for political speech. And yet, here we have people gathering outside of Supreme Court justices' houses. The scene is happening in real life.
It's also worth pointing out that this will continue to be an object lesson in media bias. The treatment of and the discussion of protesters outside the house of Brett Kavanaugh is going to be much more welcomed than people yelling at school board meetings, because those people at school board meetings who are yelling tend to be anti-mask, anti-critical race theory, or you can put that in air quotes if you want, and rude and unsettling. And so people are talking about, oh my gosh, it's really difficult to be a school board member. It's a public meeting, which these people are showing up and participating in the process. And that's been greeted with a certain amount of panic journalistically. And I don't think we'll see the same type of treatment of these protesters. I'm also really just excited about the idea that tweets can pelt you. It's just it was a word of the wise for those of you who experience life on Twitter and are uncomfortable with the feeling of being pelted by other people typing words. You can adjust your notifications so that you don't have to look at them, or at and least you don't have to look at them for most people.
You have to turn on the anti-pelting setting.
I would like to have that.
I think Elon Musk's big new feature.
Yeah.
Anti-pelting.
It's an edit button and then the anti-pelting setting. Yeah, I mean, I think this is at least, you know, I think it is right to point out that when you make protest outside of the symbolic institutional venue of these decisions, people will take their protests elsewhere. And this is like yet another bad downstream consequence of January 6th. I will say the day that the Dobbs thing leaked, my very, very first reaction was, oh, dear God, they're going to do a lefty January 6th at the Supreme Court. And that will be bad in and of itself, but also I will literally have to go to a desert island with no internet because I will not be able to handle the hypocrisy that will result in the coverage of this. Now, thankfully, that has not happened. It did not happen. It did not happen. So we do not have to fight about the parallelism there. But I think that, you know, it is not John Roberts or Brett Kavanaugh, the person who is primarily responsible for the fact that Roe might be overturned. It is the sum totality of our politics. It is the specific power we have vested in the institution of the courts. It would be correct to protest outside of government buildings. It is far less metaphorically correct to protest outside of an individual's home. As we have said, it should be legal, especially on public sidewalks and public spaces. But I regret that we have so closed off our institutions of government and access to them for speech by citizens that this feels like the best way to communicate with these decision makers.
I live around the corner on Bleecker Street from Planned Parenthood in New York, and there are always people protesting, sometimes silently, sometimes holding signs, other times really loudly with amplifiers and things like that. You know, that kind of protest and demonstration is good. What's particularly horrifying about all of this stuff is that there is a history of violence, particularly against abortion providers, you know, when this stuff happens. I also was in Buffalo when there were a bunch of Operation Rescue protests in the early 90s that got extremely violent. So this is deeply, deeply worrying. And I think Catherine is right that there should be a way made to allow people to actually protest in front of the Supreme Court or in front of Congress, in front of, you know, that would, it's not going to get rid of the people who are going to go to, you know, the justices' houses. But this is scary stuff.
I lived in the panhandle of Florida in the 1990s when Dr. David Gunn, the abortion provider, was shot in Pensacola, Florida, by an anti-abortion activist. I mean, it was pretty close to home for me.
And I grew up in Long Beach in the 1970s and 80s, and nothing happened. All right, we're going to get to our listener email of the week here in a moment. But first, worried about living in a media bubble? Peter, having a hard time finding views that challenge your own? That's where The Lost Debate steps in. The Lost Debate is a podcast and YouTube show for independent political thinkers who crave a variety of well-informed perspectives. The three co-hosts of The Lost Debate come from all across the political spectrum. Former Obama administration staffer and school principal Ravi Gupta, progressive political organizer turned TikTok star, because of course, Corey Bradford, and our own pal Ricky Schlott, a proud Gen Zer, and a New York Post contributor who loves herself some free speech. The Lost Debate is more a conversation than Shout Fest. New episodes drop wherever you find podcasts on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Check out The Lost Debate today. You'll be glad you did. All right, as ever, send your queries to roundtable@reason.com. Try to keep them short and snappy, as this one from Matt Dierstein did not. Though I will get to the meat of the matter by reading the parts that I pre-bolded just for that purposes. Here goes, from Matt. It seems to me that ostensibly public health or public good policies at their core often betray a deep condescension on the part of the people in charge. I think I read pretty good air quotes here. That's what I'm thinking. In the case of cigarettes, Jacob Sullum says that the menthol ban suggests that consumers are no match for big tobacco's persuasive wiles. And similarly, it seems like a lot of the mis/disinformation discourse imagines the American public as empty vessels, just waiting to be filled with Russian propaganda, vaccine misinformation, claims of election fraud, or whatever the topic of the moment is, and assumes that people just simply aren't smart enough or capable, to determine what's true from what isn't. Catherine touched on the importance of media literacy this past week, and all of you have touched on it in different ways in other episodes, but I'd be interested in hearing more about how you see the role that personal responsibility should have in figuring out the quality of information. Catherine?
I think that the role of personal responsibility in figuring out the quality of information is paramount, is nearly infinite. And that, yes, the question writer is quite right to point out that there is a tremendous amount of condescension in the notion that somehow someone somewhere with political power knows better than you how you should live your life. This is like some good classic libertarianism 101 stuff. I do think that for whatever reason, both sides, and by both sides, I don't even know what I mean anymore because the horseshoe is forever stomping on my face, but both sides of the debate over some of these kind of individual liberty, right to choose sins type topics, you know, they somehow want people to be less savvy than they are. Right. If people are morons, then the state must step in is sort of a proposition that works well for people who hold power. And actually, there's tons of evidence that people are very, very savvy consumers of media in some ways. Now, there's also a lot of evidence that people are super great at believing A and not A simultaneously, that people are not necessarily sort of, robustly systematic thinkers about matters such as politics or personal nutrition or even their own health. But it's not because they're duped. It's because they have other priorities. And I think the notion that the state is going to protect people from being duped by the Russians or the cigarette companies or whatever else it is fundamentally misunderstands why people choose to share crappy Russian Facebook memes or smoke menthols. It's not because they don't know what's going on. It's because they want to do those things anyway for other reasons.
Or maybe they want to be duped. What say you, Nick?
Yeah, the government, you know, public health should be, intervention should be related to things that are obviously about public health, not about individual choices. And, you know, it's things like communicable diseases and whatnot. The argument to say, oh, well, we got to ban menthol cigarettes because people keep using them after we tell them not to, you know, you tie that into public health by saying so much of healthcare is socialized that, you know, you, Matt Welch, being, you know, a fat shit and eating a bad diet and smoking Kools or Newports cost me money. And it's like the answer to that is to desocialize healthcare, not to tell the, you know, not to have the government start enforcing more and more mandates on every aspect of our private behavior.
Peter?
Obviously, people have a responsibility to educate themselves and to judge the quality of the information they are consuming. But I think something that most people overlook is that the market, left more or less to its own devices, makes it easier to take responsibility because it provides information as well as independent verification of that information to people who demand it, because information is a market good. And so when one source doesn't provide it, that creates a market opportunity, right? So if a corporation is playing fast and loose with product information or just not revealing stuff about what's in the thing that they want to sell you, that means that journalists or just guys on Twitter or Facebook can provide that information. There's a ton of this in the world of alcohol and in particular in the world of whiskey, which until relatively recently was often like sort of shrouded in mystery and like hokum. Like company brands would just sort of pop up with these stories about how they found their grandpa's old recipe, you know, from the moonshining bootlegger days, and then would turn out to be something that was written by a PR consultant. But we found that out because there were whiskey nerds who were super obsessed, who wanted to find the truth. And now, because of this, because whiskey nerds have demanded information, there is a trend amongst whiskey producers to label more accurately and provide more transparent information because that is a market good and it's something that people will pay for and appreciate your product more for. Now, obviously, this is somewhat difficult in the realm of politics. Even still, to the extent, you know, this is why we have unfettered free speech is because politicians might lie to you, but then there is a competition amongst journalists to find out, hey, this person is saying things that isn't true. They are relying on bad statistics. They are, you know, trying to fool you in whatever way. And competition for providing information, markets actually do a better job of making it easier for those of us who want to consume information and make decisions about it on our own to do so.
Yeah, and just to follow up on that, the other point that people in public health almost always forget, including wanting to regulate media or free speech, is, you know, people see the world differently. They not only have different value systems, they have different epistemology. And the point of America, you know, as an experiment is not to make everybody believe the one true thing. It's to let people alone as much as possible to believe every stupid thing that they absolutely believe is truth with a capital T, as long as it's not, you know, manifestly screwing with everybody else's ability to just get on with their lives.
And that's why there's huge value in argument and in allowing people to make claims, even sometimes that are wrong or that you believe that are, you know, offensive, is that the way that the markets provide information to people is by allowing different people with different views to say different things and then other people to look and say, look, I'm going to decide with one, you know, with one or the other. And in many cases, like the thing that is obviously true is the thing that ends up winning out.
I have long described the kind of condescension at the heart of the question for Matt, not that Matt has the condescension, but he's describing the people have in talking about these things and in enacting these rules as a sheep theory, right? The theory that we're all just sheep and we're susceptible to the latest shepherd telling us which way to go. And I've always found there's to be two main problems with that. One is that, first of all, that we're all stupid and easily susceptible and can be moved. It gets you. It's inaccurate. I don't think it's an accurate portrayal of the kind of diversity of different whatever systems that Nick was talking about, a lot of syllables. But also that it's what people go to when they lose an argument or when they lose a politics. It goes very, very quickly from there to kind of a false consciousness where you just look around and say, what's the matter with Kansas? How come these people who I swear to God my economics work for don't vote for my economics? I can't believe that's happening. And you're going to see a lot of that again in November if and when Democrats lose as much as it would seem that they will in the first midterm of an unpopular presidency. There's going to be a lot of people pointing at Fox News about Facebook, about misinformation, about disinformation as a way for themselves to process their own or their sort of team's own failure to win the question. And all of that, it's inaccurate and it's kind of ugly. False consciousness is almost in every case kind of an ugly expression that you know more than a person in their own actions. There's a flip side of that too, though, that builds on what Peter's talking about. Like, there has to be demand side action to get more and better media and commentary and journalism and et cetera. And that's where media literacy specifically comes. It starts in the home, like perestroika, begins in the home. And you got to do something with it. There was over the weekend, Sarah Haider, activist thinker, you spell her last name Haider. She wrote a thing on her Substack that just kind of stuck with me. She was talking about the kind of disputes that Christopher Rufo, who is this activist who's been very central to the anti-critical race theory laws and rewriting things in Florida about what teachers can and cannot kind of say in classrooms having to do with race or gender. So Chris Rufo gets in a lot of fights with journalists who otherwise share some of his concerns about where public education is going. And, you know, he says, you and your fancy pants people over here, they don't understand that the important thing is to win and et cetera. Sarah Haider had a simple sentence and it stuck with me. which is as follows. There is a fundamental disconnect between the functions of two different classes of discourse participants, those who use language to think and discover truth, and those who use it as a means to power. And though it might sound, and this is me talking now, she's done with her quote, it might sound as that that is sort of, you know, tautologically self-congratulatory of a certain journalistic mindset or theoretically journalistic mindset, it's worth thinking about in terms of how you consume information. Is the person who is saying it to you, and those people very may well be journalists, and many times they are, I think increasingly so at mainstream institutions, are they trying to get you to do a political outcome? Are they trying to change your behavior in the way that the CDC is trying to get you to stop smoking menthol cigarettes? Or are they trying to give you information with which they hope you do whatever you want to do with? That their goal is as information providers. That's an important step to media literacy and like to understand why you are seeking that out. Why do you have that radio station on in the background or that podcast on, including this one, on in the background? Is it to provide you with information, to make you laugh, to challenge you with this and that, or to envelop you in a warm bath of kind of same thinkers? All of that is built into this, and it's the best antidote to making the inaccurate sheep theory true is by individuals beginning to shape their media experience and be able to identify it for what it is, and also identify especially politicians, but a lot of the people in the firmament of political action, identify what they are doing not as truth claims. Ron DeSantis is not in the business of truth. He's in the business of winning elections. And that is true of every Democrat as well. This is what people do, and take your approach and listening devices accordingly.
Where would you put Ibram Kendi or Robin DiAngelo in that map?
In a bad place. I mean, their analysis is really, really, really bad. They go to a different place of Robin DiAngelo, especially, whose work I'm more familiar with. I mean, it's addressed to white people, telling them why they should feel bad, even like the white people who otherwise, agree with that racism is all encompassing and is awful. It's still not enough. It's basically trying to get you in a cycle of almost tithing, of giving, of going through constant re-education, giving money to counselors, doing this, paying penance, shutting up. In a lot of different ways. So that's playing actively to this sort of sense of pervasive collective guilt, and in the process describing things that aren't true and having an analysis of the world around them in such a ham-handedly awful way that there's even no policy discussed of what she's doing. I wrote a semi-review of her last book, Nice Racism. There it is on the shelf. That's aimed like that. And it's amazing how in an entire grown person's book, there isn't any policy discussed at all. You would think that if your whole life is based on, your whole career is based on like identifying this problem, that you would say, here's a proposed solution to this problem. But there's not. The proposed solution is that, like perestroika beginning in the home, anti-racism begins in the home by buying more books like Nice Racism and then subjecting yourself to that. So,
It's a real contrast too to the actual legal or law school practitioners and creators of critical race theory. And I'm thinking of people like Derek Bell, who actually wrote critically of Brown versus Board of Education, of that ruling for a variety of reasons, and also was an early, in his early work, he was a proponent of school choice. Not that there aren't things right and wrong with critical race theory, but when you look at the actual academic work as opposed to the kind of applied versions of this stuff, oftentimes you will find a search for truth and underlying social reality and history that is almost completely missing from the conversations that people like Chris Rufo on the one hand and Robin DiAngelo on the other are having.
I mean, Ibram Kendi has... And a lot of people who are are self described as anti-racists, just sort of as a category label, work backwards from any lopsided measurement having to do with race. And if it is overwhelming, or not even overwhelming, if there's a you know, in the New York public school system, for example, if there's a school that is one of the best, you know, it's an elite school, and there's too many Asians, then that's racism, because there's not enough, in this case, black and brown people is the way they describe it locally. And as I wrote in a piece about the equity mess about a year ago, if you start doing that in all consistently across all policies, you're going to find a whole lot of things that Democrats in particular, the people who've been more open to this type of analysis, it's going to start looking ugly. I mean, beginning with school closures, particularly during the pandemic, that has affected poorer people, blacker people, browner people, than it like almost any other policy you could name currently in front of us. So, but people do not tend to apply such analysis consistently across the board. It's more opportunistically for their own purposes, or just for their to fit in a certain politics. And I find that most people don't actually read those books. They're assigned them either in school or in diversity, equity, and inclusion trainings. I've gotten, you know, scores of emails from people, you know, who had to read these things, and they might dip into them. But if you actually subject yourself to reading an entire Ibram X. Kendi book, you will be shocked by how awful it is. And that's not even in terms of what the conclusions are, but in terms of the basic writing, the basic scholarship, it's awful. The guy won a National Book Award. And at some point that's going to be seen as one of the last nails in the coffin of the National Book Award as an institution. It's really, really awful stuff. Now I've talked for way too long, Nick. That's your fault. All right, let's go to our end of podcast, what you have been consuming in the cultural sphere. Catherine, please relieve me from the sound of my own voice.
I went to a movie, an unprecedented move for yours truly, at the slightly intoxicated insistence of one Peter Suderman, who told me that this was the greatest movie of the decade. I went to see Everything Everywhere All at Once at a movie theater yesterday, and it was a very good movie. I'm not going to lie. I really genuinely wished that I did not have children, that I had perhaps aborted them even, so that I could have done a back-to-back screening of Doctor Strange immediately afterward.
We're going to get there. Just wait a couple of minutes here.
Because I suspect that they are the same movie, but with such spectacularly different aesthetics and characterization as to make your brain struggle to see them as the same movie. I'm not sure, because I haven't seen the Doctor Strange movie yet. But this is a movie about multiverses, and it is the main character is a kind of middle-aged mom immigrant from Hong Kong, I think, who owns a coin-operated laundromat. And it ends with the question of whether anything matters, and if so, whether we should choose certain actions or not. But the propelling force of the movie is that they are really, really, really trying to deal with an IRS tax audit. And it's incredible. It was really just like genuinely weird and enjoyable. But all of the places where you were like, what? This is ridiculous. What's going on here? If everyone had just been wearing spandex and a cape, you would accept it uncritically. That this is my suspicion, is that like every place that this movie's like slight realism called you back to reality, in the absence of that, in like with a just a glossier CGI, you could make a much stupider version of this movie and it would be perhaps more palatable. This was a pretty smart version of the movie, I would say. It also had Jamie Lee Curtis as the supervillain slash tax auditor slash unkillable kind of Neo in the Matrix style monster person. So do recommend that as well, because always Jamie Lee Curtis. So Everything Everywhere All at Once was, as the title suggests, a lot, and should probably be viewed alongside Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness, which I think is Peter's recommendation. Is that true?
Indeed it is.
Okay.
Nope. Everything Everywhere All at Once is a much better movie than Doctor Strange. Everything Everywhere is like an adult Pixar movie, but by way of like 1990s Jackie Chan and The Matrix, as if written by Charlie Kaufman in his Being John Malkovich stage, with like also an extended shout out to 2001: A Space Odyssey somewhere in there. It's just like I really.
But it's also a movie for the overworked mom struggling to connect with her teenage daughter. Just yes, to be clear,
all of those things, and somehow or another manages to balance all of them really, really well. It doesn't feel like it is. It's both too much and exactly the right amount.
There's one multiverse in which the main character looks at an alternate universe version of her husband and says, like a critical plot moment, and looks into his eyes and says, "I saw my life without you. It was beautiful." Oh. Like, it's just weird as hell, this movie.
Well, also, anyway. Right. And so a bunch of that is an extended Wong Kar-wai reference, which I,
sure,
right?
Of course. Like, I definitely mean, knew that.
So, and again, this is a movie that works on those levels. Like, if you know Wong Kar-wai's filmography, you look at this movie and be like, oh, I really see how this whole thing is just a weird riff on Wong Kar-wai's, like, science fiction and romance films. But also, if you don't know anything about that, you'll just be like, this is a movie about how utterly fucking strange it is to be a person.
Yeah. Sorry to interrupt you. Go ahead.
Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness is a movie that is also too much. And yet it is also not enough. It's not nearly as good as Everything Everywhere, even though it cost about 8 times as much to make. It's a movie that is at war with itself between the imperatives of the big Marvel movie, right, with crossovers and Easter eggs and all
By
sorts of gimmicks for the
Mammu.
Fans.
It's
right, I mean, like, this
itself.
Is, you know, this is, like, it kind of creatively feels like it's constantly punching itself in the face Bruce Campbell in the Army of Dead movies, right, who is constantly punching himself in the face and, in fact, has a cameo and shows up to, I won't say what, in this movie. Right, and so it's warring between the sort of MCU kind of bland house style with a whole lot of where, at this point, the Easter eggs and the references have become the point, and Sam Raimi movies. And Sam Raimi, of course, is the guy who gave us the Evil Dead films, as well as the original Spider-Man trilogy. The Evil Dead films in particular are like reference points here. Those movies were great because they were, in the words of James Cameron, horror cartoons. And he made like gross out splatter films that also had the vibe of like Looney Tunes cartoons. And like somehow or another combined those two sensibilities to great, great effect in Evil Dead 2. Strongly, strongly recommend that if you are in college, find a midnight screening of Evil Dead 2 and just like go and it like The midnight screening I watched at the Kentucky Theater in probably 2000, the State Theater in downtown Lexington, is like one of the most memorable experiences I've ever had in my life. The crowd was like pretty drunk and rowdy, and Bruce Campbell was going to be in town that weekend, and it was just absolutely delightful. This movie is not nearly as delightful, but there's a bunch of stuff in it that works, and it's mostly the stuff that feels like Sam Raimi being Sam Raimi. It just doesn't all connect together and doesn't hold together, unlike Everything Everywhere All at Once, which just sort of manages to create the biggest Dagwood sandwich of multiversal ideas, and it's freaking delicious. And this one is a mess. It sort of falls apart constantly. It gets better in the second hour. And I didn't dislike it. I was glad to have seen it, but I think there's real, like, it's very instructive about the ways that Marvel and its creators don't always figure out ways to gel and vibe together.
Nick, wake up. And also, what did you consume?
Unfortunately, I also consumed a metafictional self-referential movie, The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent, which stars Nicolas Cage as Nicolas Cage, where he is financially strapped and has to agree to basically go to a shadowy, multi-millionaires island in Mallorca to entertain
him. A compound.
Yeah, well, it becomes a compound, right? And it is very funny and very good because it's all about what an insanely weird and mostly wasted talent Nicolas Cage is as an actor. And this is a guy who, Kurt Loder had a collection of film reviews that he had done, both for Reason and various other places over the years, a few years back that came out, The Good, The Bad, and The God-Awful, which had an entire section devoted to Nicolas Cage. There is a podcast called Cage Travolta, which is about how awful John Travolta and Nicolas Cage movies are, and also how kind of wonderful. This plays into that. It's very funny. It's metafictional. It has Tiffany Haddish in it. It's really an interesting kind of, you know, through the mirror, you know, it's something like what the last action hero in many ways was trying to do. And it's really good, but the critique of Nicolas Cage's wasted talent and his personal hubris and arrogance and solipsism isn't fully realized, because in the end, it's a Hollywood movie about Nicolas Cage, so he has to be the hero. But I highly recommend The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent. If, as Peter was talking about the Doctor Strange movie, if you know Nick Cage's filmography, and I'm pretty deep into it, this has callbacks to everything from The Wicker Man to, you know, The Rock, to Face Off, of course, but also to a couple of the more obscure movies earlier in his career, including things like Rumblefish and Birdie, which is, by the way, is a fantastic movie.
Terrific. But
Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent, a pleasant way to blow $20. And of course, what's good about a $20 ticket is that by the time the movie's over, you've really only spent, you know, $16 or $17.
I get that.
Due to inflation.
That. I get
wow.
that.
Wow, he had to good. Explain that to you? Okay.
He
okay.
did. He did. Yeah. Peter, what order should that trifecta, that triple bill, be watched?
Oh, Everything Everywhere All at Once you should watch first, and then Doctor Strange, and then the Nicolas Cage movie, which I didn't like nearly as much as Nick did.
Wouldn't you make a little sandwich out of it? A little multiversal sandwich? Put Nick Cage in the, as the
Nick
meat?
Nick Cage, it's not multiverse.
That's
no,
what I'm saying.
I think multiverse is actually kind of exhausting, and Nicolas Cage is a good palate cleanser after you've seen it. I probably would have enjoyed Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent a little more had I seen it as a double feature after Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness.
So what I watched was what I've mentioned before, but it was the last episode last night of Winning Time on HBO, the story of the rise of the Lakers dynasty of the 1980s with Magic Johnson, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Jerry Buss as the novice owner of the Lakers. And I just loved it very much. I will not tell you that it is great, because it is not great, but it is greatly enjoyable. It's probably the first television program that I have watched as it was happening in a long time. Like 15 years? I don't know. Some horrendous amount of time. It speaks to my own deep psychological issues with 1980s Southern California and Magic Johnson and the Lakers and such like. I was watching the final episode last night in which they're playing the championship series in 1980 against Philadelphia, their first title of that run. And I was trying to remember, like, was this game the one that I saw? Because I saw one of the finals games at the Fabulous Forum that year. And it's just great. And the arc of the story, when I'd mentioned this before, had talked about how Kareem Abdul-Jabbar was winningly portrayed as just a dick early on. And he's very, like, redemptively comes through. And in fact, he did in real life, like, really played incredibly and heroically in those finals. And also was just a kind of illustrated what makes Kareem great, besides beating Catherine Mangue Ward at every single journalistic Bastard. Competition in which they're both finalists. But like his sort of prickly intelligence and kind of emotional aptitudes and weirdness. It's very enjoyable. And again, it's a meditation on management, which is always going to work in any television sense. And just kind of the alchemy that is involved when people try to figure out how to make a collective enterprise go in different directions. The Jerry West character is just so winningly furious and alcoholic. I love it very, very much.
Do you agree, though, with self-defined penis eater Bill Plaschke, that the depiction of Jerry West is almost to the level of defamation of character?
No, I don't. Jerry West, by all accounts, and I'm reading the Jeff Perlman book, Showtime, on which this is based, and also following Perlman on Twitter, although he's a rough follow, because he gets his politics in it. But West is an anger bear. Like, go if you go down the rabbit holes of YouTube, And sorry, Catherine, I always use that phrase, but and see like interviews with Jerry West, like from 5 years ago, talking about losing to the Celtics as a player in the 60s, he still wants to choke somebody out. Like he has to stop himself. He's like welling up with tears of fury. He's just like, dude's tightly wound. He really did break golf clubs on the course gratuitously and just was kind of famously unhappy even with winning. So yeah, all the characters are caricatures. I think that Paul Westhead, the interim coach, probably gets the toughest deal. Also, Chick Hearn, who to me is the real hero of the Lakers, always was kind of portrayed as a buffoon, which I refuse to accept. But Adrian Brody as Pat Riley, that is the spinoff thing that I wanted. I can't believe how good that is. How good he is that as well as Quincy Isaiah, I believe his name is, who plays Magic Johnson. It's terrific. Anyways. It is idiosyncratic to me, to be sure, but the people I know who have watched it contemporaneously, with the exception of basketball journalist Ethan Strauss, does not like it. I think people who know too much have a problem with it, like Bill Plaschke. But if you lie back and think of Mother England and just accept the 80s as it washes over you, it's a beautiful thing.
Matt Welch, exit question. Can the NBA ever recover the immensity of the 80s as a decade when it was really challenging? You'll recall people were like, oh, this is America's pastime. Forget football or baseball.
Part of that is, I think, the style of play, which right now is really unlovely. Three-pointers and not much else and flopping. And the Lakers, and this is an underappreciated part of both the actual story and of the HBO series, is that they kind of created a new style of basketball that was way more aesthetically pleasing. Fast break all the time, and people can use improvisation and athleticism in a way that was not boring. It was very, very exciting and thrilling. And it was new. And to forge, like in any big change of strategy, the first people who have to do it are a little bit eccentric. And so I think you'd have to change the rules of basketball, move the three-point line.
Maybe that's the time to do it. I also want to put in a plug, Matt. You mentioned Philadelphia in 1980, but the 76ers, which had a ton of ABA-influenced juice going on, so important to what a fucking great basketball decade.
Yeah, it was. And sorry, Catherine's just been nodding off.
This is the sound booth. It's like
yawned.
That scene at the beginning of The Prisoner where gas is knocking them out.
Yeah,
you know, it's like. But they get
short shrift. Oh, the conceit of the series is that it has to all be about Larry Bird and the Celtics. Yeah. And it just wasn't. The first 5 years of that decade, that was the rivalry.
But there was more back and forth. Right? Yeah. I mean, in a lot of ways, you could say that Michael Jordan killed the NBA.
Ooh,
you know, the Bulls' dominance, it just kind of like, after a certain point.
Subject of another podcast, Nick Gillespie. Speaking of which, look at all of our, look at them. You can listen to them too. Reason.com podcasts, including the aforementioned The Reason interview with Nick Gillespie, the Soho Forum series. Very excited about tonight's rumble in the concrete
in the
jungle with Elizabeth Brown. Check them all out. And also, if you like our business in general, reason.com/donate. Give money. All right. Goodbye.